Previously on Falling Low.
When it hit, I heard this jet go over, and it sounded like it was just flying low, and then all of a sudden, boom.
Somebody came in and said the Air National Guard jet had crashed over by Story City. And my first comment was, I hope it wasn't John Rooks and his navigator, not knowing that's who it was.
And I just kept asking, what does it look like? What does it look like? What does it look like? Everything's gone. They just kept saying, everything's gone. It's all gone. And I could not wrap my head around that.
Adjutant General May from the Iowa National Guard came to see me. He was dressed in full military attire with many decorations on his chest. Very impressive. His driver introduced us, we shook hands, and he said, who are you going to sue? I was completely speechless. Sue?
My double cousin Rebecca reads the account written by my grandma Marie, who passed away in 2002. Most of what my grandma wrote about was the fight that she had to face to be compensated for the destruction caused by the National Guard jet crash that was on a federal Air Force training mission.
Sue? I said, do I have to sue? Well, he said, you have to sue the state of Iowa or the federal government. For pity's sake, I'm trying to get my family together. I haven't had a chance to think about such yet. What a blow. What were they expecting of me? What were they thinking of? I told him I was not ready to make such a decision yet. We were innocent victims and we had to sue to recover what was destroyed. I must be hearing wrong.
52 days after the crash that had happened on December 9th, 1968, my grandpa Pete died, leaving my grandma Marie on her own to figure out what to do now that they had lost everything. They lost their home, their belongings, everything they needed to run their farm, as well as the previous year's harvest. On top of all this, in the spring of 1969, she was now having to face sending at least one of her sons to the Vietnam War.
Both Michael and Martin had draft numbers and were of the age to go into military service. Michael had had 2 years of college. Martin was not a student. He had been a farmer since he was 2 years old.
I sat down with my mom, Sigrid, and my brother, Ross, to talk with my uncle, Mike, about his deployment. He was 20 at the time and had spent 2 years at Bethany College in Minnesota.
I had been 2 years at Bethany, and I thought I was going to go on, and I was just flat out of money. You know what I mean? So military at that time gave you $231 a month to go to school. So, well, I'll go in military. I'll have 2 years. I can get through school, you know, have the money. Because back then, you know, a quarter at Iowa State was only $300. You know what I mean? Compared to my son when he went down there, it was $9,000 a year at that time. And it's much higher now, you know. Compared to back then, it was $300 a quarter.
So what were you going to go into?
Gerald had docked me into medical technology.
Oh.
That's what I was. And then I'll never forget it. We were doing maneuvers in Georgia all day long. We'd been playing war out in Georgia in the swamps. And it was 11, 12 o'clock at night. The moon is full. And I'm sitting on a truck going back to the base, the barracks, and thinking, God, I love being outside. And the thought came to me, I can't be inside doing stuff. I'll never forget. That's the night I made the decision that probably I'm not going to go back to school. You're going to find something you can do outside. You know what I mean?
Very epiphany. Yeah.
Now, that was down in Georgia in April. If I'd been in Iowa, maybe in April, I wouldn't have made that. But at that time, I'm supposed to be outside doing something, you know?
Well, with medical technology, too, you would have had to deal with a lot more people.
Yeah, I know. And at that time, I wasn't quite as adverse.
Well, no. Weren't quite the hermit.
That came maybe 3-4 years later, you know?
So in April, Michael went into the service. What a sad day. Gruesome pictures of Vietnam loomed big on the television.
I got on a plane April 9th out of Des Moines. And then I got to visit Louisiana. That's where I went to basic training. And then went to advanced infantry training. And I walked in there and they made me a platoon leader because I'd been to school to be a leader. That was 2 weeks. They prepared you to be a leader. Well, why not? You know, little did they know I'm not a scholar. I don't do well in school. And then went to jump school and then went to other places and then finally ended up in Texas at Fort Hood. And then finally across the pond. But it was about a year of training before I went over. And then in the meantime, Martin got married. I was supposed to be the best man, but I couldn't get away.
On June 9th, 1969, Martin was married to Diane Sorensen of Story City, and we were busy with farm work and wedding plans. They bought a house trailer and moved it to the farm and lived there. My Uncle Martin, who had turned 19 in April, was now in charge of the farm, rebuilding the family farm business just from the land that was left, as well as starting his new life with his wife, my Aunt Diane. Now, three people had left our home, so we really did not need such a big house. Herman could go on his own now that we no longer would be living at Falling Low, and another generation would take over. I had to go work away from the home for the first time since I was married to Pete. I took the training to be a homemaker health aide in Story County. My grandma got married to my grandpa Pete in 1947 when she was 30 years old. Before that, she was a civilian in the Air Force in Chicago during World War II. She was also a teacher and was the dean of women at Bethany College when she met my grandpa Pete. After 22 years of living and working on Falling Low Farm, my grandma now had to find a new career at the age of 52 to make ends meet for her family. Meanwhile, my Uncle Mike, after his year of training, was deployed to Vietnam.
So then how long were you away from the farm and then came back?
That was probably pretty close to 3.5-4 years, you know. I remember I was back, but I wasn't feeling good.
After only a few months in Vietnam, he became deathly ill, which led to a lifetime of complicated medical conditions.
One day I got up and I wasn't feeling good, terrible headache. I knew it wasn't a hangover. Went out, took a leak, and it was black. I had malaria. Living in the bush, living filth, mud, people that carry their bathroom around with them, you know what I mean? It's a wonder anybody survived that hole. Now, see, they were supposed to be bringing us pills, but they couldn't always get us supplied, you know? Because I was worried when I saw that, uh-oh, I've been drinking water and haven't been, you know, every time you drank water, you had to put an iodine pill in it, you know what I mean? That sped it up so you didn't have to boil it, that kind of stuff. But anyway, I figured something, no problem. I had a fever and they just put me in a bed for a while and then went back. And then one night, one of the guys said, your eyeballs are bright yellow. And I wasn't feeling good, but I, you know, you just got used to it. You know what I mean? So went to the sick call the next morning. And they put me on a chopper to Benoit, and in an hospital I went. And that's the last I remember for several days.
There was a period of time when the family had no idea where Mike was, or if he was even alive.
I remember waking up in a bathtub full of ice and shivering, wondering, what the hell am I doing in here? You know what I mean? Because I can't get warm. Well, I had a 104, 105 fever. You know, and they were trying to break that. Then they decided that my bile duct was full of liver flukes, which is a worm that, and so the bile was backing up in the liver and causing scarring and tissue damage. You know, so then when I finally got to the States, stabilized enough to get back to the States, then they did an exploratory surgery.
You're a walking miracle, Mike.
You betcha. I've been proclaiming that for years and nobody listens.
Now it's on tape.
Yeah. You survive a plane crash, you survive
Vietnam
and being sick.
But that was the first of your surgeries.
Oh, yeah. The third surgery was repair of the first surgery because I didn't really listen to the doctors and I got adhesions because from the first surgery. Then I had a surgery for a burst appendix.
I thought you had the bowel obstruction first.
Now, that could have happened. I don't remember. That could have.
Because that was still out of Fitzsimmons.
Yeah, okay.
The
yeah.
appendix was here.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'd come home.
Des Moines.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, 5 surgeries and they never took his appendix?
See, and that's what baffled them. That's why they burst. And I ended up in a hospital for a month from appendicitis because I was just peritonitis everywhere. You know, they had burst and that infection was everywhere. So they had to leave a hole in me and watch it drain, you know, and get rid of that. Because SOP, standard operating procedure, was in Denver, they should have snipped the appendix and they assumed that had been done. So it wasn't the appendix. It couldn't be. See what I mean? And then finally they decide, we got to go in there and look. And that's what they found, you know. That was just a pus pocket, you know.
And an angry one.
Once again, here's my cousin Rebecca reading from my grandma's account. During his recuperation at Fort Riley in Kansas, he got to come home for a short visit. He told me what clothes to send for the trip, and I followed orders. As he got out of the car in front of our house at 910 8th Street, he stretched after traveling many miles, and his pants fell to his ankles. He was so thin and yellow jaundiced.
I came home once when I was down at Irwin, and they're supposed to bring clothes down to me. And I had gone into the service. I was about 175 pounds. Because for 30 days, I just ate through tubes, you know. Best meal I ever had in my life was beef broth and melted Jell-O with skim milk. I would lay awake at night dreaming about roast beef and sweet corn because I wasn't allowed to eat anything. And so I was like 122, 23 pounds. And then they brought me pants and I'm walking around holding them up. You know, you put a shirt on and a short sleeve shirt was down to here. You know what I mean? It was just, you know.
But he would turn colors.
Mm-hmm.
He was pretty much perpetually gold.
Yeah.
You know, the jaundice.
Yeah.
But then he'd get tired and it would be a nasty shade of green.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he was exhausted or running a fever or whatever, then it was almost black. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, very dark. And Mom, for Christmas, she wanted to get him a nice suit. And she got you, do you remember that suit and tie with the shirt? And they were all different shades of green. And they yeah. clashed so bad with them that yeah. we all just sat and laughed. I mean, it was just like Kermit.
Yeah.
It was just yeah. awful. I think we ended up taking it back and getting you a brown one, but oh God, it was. But yeah, I passed him on the street and I didn't know who it was. Had no clue it was Brother Mike, you know, just unrecognizable. And then Ada was in the picture by then when you finally got, you were at Fitzsimmons, what, 6 months?
Yeah, probably.
6 or 7 months. And before that, it was, I mean, it was over a year in hospitals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Way over a year, probably.
Yeah, I know I was supposed to have gotten out of the service, but they wouldn't let me out until they had got everything cleared up, you know, that kind of thing, so.
Eventually, Mike was sent to Fitzsimmons Hospital in Denver, Colorado, where he had exploratory surgery, and they found 20% of his liver was not functioning. He was dismissed from Fitzsimmons in December 1970, but not from military service. Mike met Ada Rood from Ellsworth on a blind date when he was home on furlough, and with her encouragement and phone calls and visits, he made it through 3 surgeries. They were married in June 1972. Again, God has been very good and spared Mike to us.
On top of coping with Mike's medical saga and adjusting to a new career at the age of 52, my grandma Marie was expected to create a detailed inventory of every item that was destroyed in order to be compensated by the government.
Falling Low Farm belonged to Pete's mother, Jenny Chernoggle. Herman and Pete farmed the land for her. Her sister-in-law, Bertha Chernoggle, an unmarried nurse, came to Falling Low Farm to care for Jenny after her severe stroke.
Bertha had a small building on the farm with some of her belongings in it, and as a result, there were 5 different claims to be settled with the Air Force. Jenny Chernoggle Estate, Bertha Chernoggle Estate, Peter Chernoggle Estate, H. and Pierre Chernoggle Interest, and Herman Chernoggle Interest.
Well, first of all, we had to list absolutely every single solitary object that we could remember, because they told us if it wasn't listed, we weren't going to get paid for it. And they wanted to know the day it was purchased, you know, how much we paid for it, the item, what its value is now, what shape it was in. And there were many times that one of the generals would say, this item, like the music chairs, you know, they were homemade. Well, there's no price you can put on those. And so Mom would have to search out someone who did furniture and get an approximate price. And then they would argue with it and want a second opinion. And that's when Mom blew and she said, I got the first one, you didn't like it, you get the second one.
I had to make a list of every piece of clothing, summer and winter, all of us owned, every dish and utensil in our cupboards, every appliance we had, every piece of furniture, every picture on the wall, and all of the children's memorabilia from their school years. I mean, where does one start? I worked on the list often, but it was a huge task, and there were many projects and distractions. Pete's death, Tanta's death, Mike going into the military, planting spring crop, field work, and the wedding. There was the task of cleaning up the horrible mess at Falling Low. The Air Force offered to pay us for doing the job so they would not have to bring their equipment so far. It was impossible to get any long periods of time to concentrate on our claim. By August, our claim to the Air Force was completed, we thought, and it was sent in. However, it was returned because Major Reed of Tinker Air Force Base at Oklahoma requested additional information. There were maybe 2 more times that it was returned to us for more information, and each time it was mailed out, we were told to send it to another address. Well, no wonder the Air Force thought we were so late sending it in. The different government agencies didn't communicate with each other and did not realize someone else had our claim. My attorney, J.C. Brecken of Randall, and I followed instructions as closely as we knew how. At one point, I even had to put down the dates that the destroyed clothing had been purchased. I'm sure I guessed wrong about many items.
As the months went by, a new job opportunity presented itself for my Grandma Marie.
In October 1971, I had the chance to get financial help to take a refresher course for secretarial work in Des Moines. With Ingeborn High School and Sigrid and LPN School in Boone, I welcomed the opportunity. The drive to Des Moines every day was hard, but I was able to carpool with several other students, and we made it through. While I was in school, I was becoming more irritated, more frustrated, and very disgusted that our claim with the Air Force was being ignored.
It can be catastrophic losing your home, or losing your husband, or your son going into the service and ending up ill, you know. But then you combine all that while you're fighting the generals and your government, you're trying to study and go to school, driving to Des Moines every day, and then you have a 12 and a 15-year-old. And I wasn't the easiest teenager, you know.
My Aunt Ingeborg remembers my grandma's struggle.
Mom was too busy to fight it. She was, you know, taking classes, working her tail off, trying to make ends meet, plus, you know, trying to come up with an inventory of everything that we had at the farm.
I don't know how she did it.
I don't either. Mm-mm. She would attribute it all to, you know, her faith. She couldn't do it without Christ. I mean, I remember hearing her say that.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning of our ordeal, we were given the impression that the Air Force was to blame and that they would pay. It was a total surprise when they opposed payment and dumped the material of our claim with the state of Iowa. That would mean we'd have to sue the state to get compensation, and I absolutely could not be convinced that that should be necessary. I was totally an innocent victim, and I could not afford such action. My attorney wanted to go to Washington, D.C. to argue our case, but I firmly opposed that too. I mean, why did we need that expense? Who was going to pay for that? I didn't have the money.
Where would we start once we were in D.C.? Two Midwestern people striking out blindly in an unfamiliar bureaucracy that seemed relentless, unconcerned, and cold? I wanted no part of it. I was innocent. They were guilty. They had money to fight me. Let them come to me.
Next time on Falling Low.